From Tribune Tower, WGN Radio presents A Conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything that's in the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this week's edition of the Sunday Spin for June 26th, 2016. Yes, the very final Sunday in June, and just a few days before we start the state's new budget year, and that's without having a budget for the current year. Welcome to Illinois. It's time for our weekly review of politics from Scotland to Washington to Springfield with City Hall in between. Grab the Sunday paper, go get that cup of coffee. Perhaps you might want cold coffee this morning. The humidity is still pretty strong out there. We'll do our best to get your day and week off to a good start. Well, Schwani, always lots of stuff going on. The Pride Parade this afternoon.
Today's a big day, and you know, you mentioned it's the last weekend of June. That means the year is almost half over, if you can believe that.
Don't do that. Time passes quickly enough. Don't help things along. But your 50-50 call on the rain, I think you can now make it 100%.
Yeah, Bob just called up here on the intercom and said that it started raining. I can't quite see it from here, but
from the storm center patio, it was pouring heavily. It was just a brief burst. It looks like there's a lot of little spotty kind of showers going on now moving through.
Well, let it move through now and get it out of the way, and we'll be okay for the parade.
Actually, Mike Hammernick said he thought that everything should move out.
Clear out by that time?
For the parade, and then probably another chance of storms late afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a cold front moving in, and at least the one good thing about that is it'll take some of that humidity out of the air.
Yeah.
Because it was pretty stifling this morning. I don't know how you felt about it, but there was a wind blowing, but that wind just was blowing moist, humid air.
Right, yeah. It was rather stuffy, if you will, when I got in around 4 this morning. Felt the same way, really. And it was that way pretty much prior to the great big storm that rolled through the other day here. Oh, that was amazing.
Yes, that was just something. And you just had to keep your eyes focused on the radar
exactly.
And I forgot what the count finally ended up with for how many tornadoes. If it ended up at 10, I'm not sure.
Something like that. Yeah, 8 or 10.
Yeah, I mean, and thankfully, no deaths. That's amazing.
Right. As everyone pointed out, though, what's interesting about a lot of these tornadoes is that, especially when they come at night, you don't know. You know, it's one thing to see them during the day, and you can watch them kind of move in and try and touch down. But once it gets dark out, it gets rough. So when they say go to a safe place, that's what they mean, you know, because you cannot see these coming necessarily.
Yeah, no, very. It was very scary, very intense. And I was watching Mr. Skilling on Channel 9 the entire time.
Mm-hmm.
And they did a great job of covering things.
Always.
Very, very impressive stuff. And again, thankfully, no deaths that occurred. And I'm not aware of any major injuries that occurred. So, but our thoughts are with everybody down in Pontiac.
Pontiac, especially, yeah.
They got
more or less the brunt of it there.
Right.
With the power outages and so forth. People trapped in houses, motorhomes. So.
Yeah. It is that time of year, though, and there is a moderate chance of severe storms this afternoon, and that's mostly south of I-80, so and northwest Indiana. So
yeah, exactly.
Hopefully we can just have some nice rain, bring in some cooler air. It'd be nice if the Sox could bring in some pitching. I mean, so Sam,
let's bring in Sam on that one.
So it's the third time in Major League history a team has 7 home runs and loses.
Yes. Go White Sox.
Go White Sox, yes. And I'm still trying to figure out what is going on with the Cubs. I mean, They've now lost five out of the last six.
I've been told to call it a June swoon.
Well, yeah, that's kind of like the old joke about the Cubs moving to the Philippines and they're going to be called the Manila Folders. Sorry, it's an old joke. Okay,
I've never heard that one.
Because you're too young. That's probably why.
I don't know if you caught the trivia question. So Brett Laurie for the White Sox hit two home runs yesterday. Right. One over the wall. The other one was inside the park. Can you guess who the last White Sox player to do that was?
You know what? I did hear.
You did?
I did hear.
You cheated then.
Yes.
Ron Santo.
That's amazing, isn't
when
it?
He was 34 years old.
Ron Santo?
1974. He played 1 year with the White Sox.
I knew he played with the White Sox, but he hit an in-the-ballpark home run?
And over the wall in the same game.
Wow.
I know, but I'm just trying to think of Santo doing an inside-the-park home run.
I know.
At 34, yeah. Too. Not 20. So that means a right fielder was probably running back or a center fielder or a left fielder slammed into the wall, knocked himself out, and Santo just kept galloping.
I was going to say, you know, Greg Luzinski or Carlton Fisk or somebody like that, but Ron Santo, excellent.
But you saw what happened with Lowry's inside the Parker was that the ball hit towards the top of the wall, and the outfielder thought it was a home run, so he just walked away from the ball, which gave Laurie all this time to get around the bases, while the center fielder had to go retrieve the ball at the warning zone and throw it in. Let's get some winning baseball back here too.
Seven home runs and they lose.
Yes, exactly, exactly. And then, you know, we got the story about Shaw being sent off to Montreal and Andrew Shaw. I mean, just. What a great player, and it really makes you think about what are we going to do for up the middle with the Blackhawks next season.
Well, 3 years ago, 3 years, I guess, to the date before the trade, he was wearing the Stanley Cup and the stitches.
Yes.
On the cover of the Tribune. You know, he took that puck in the face in Boston, bled everywhere, I think like 15 or 20 stitches. 3 days after that day, he gets traded to Montreal, another salary cap casualty.
Yeah, it's just amazing because, you did hear those words that, you know, they were going to do their best to sign him and that kind of thing. But that cap issue is really amazing for this league. That's why I don't think you'll ever see a team ever repeat as a Stanley Cup champion because of the power of the impact of the cap on salaries. But I'm not so sure we're going to be able to do our every other year repeat this time.
You can build a team with the guys the Hawks have lost since 2010.
Oh, unbelievable. Unbelievable. We're not that far away, as Dave points out, since we're almost halfway through the year. We're not that far away from hockey season, right?
And the convention coming up.
That's right, the big convention coming up, which I believe that the Blackhawks convention, while I hope everybody goes and has a good time, I'll be at the other convention that'll be going on then.
Let's see, how many shopping days until Christmas? Oh, let's not go there yet.
Thanks.
We'll wait till after the 4th of July.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Shawnee. Well, did you see all the tourists in town this week, too?
Oh, yeah.
And of course, here's...
I was stopped twice. Yes. For people asking directions this week.
I got stopped outside Tribune Tower by a staircase that over the top of the staircase to Lower Michigan Avenue, over the top of the staircase, it says 4 blocks to Navy Pier. And I was stopped by two.
Where is Navy Pier?
Correct. I was stopped by two people asking me, yeah, how do you get to Navy Pier? And they were walking towards the river.
They were walking toward the river?
Yeah. As I believe they came up those stairs.
Okay.
So.
Did you walk over there with them?
To the Navy Pier?
Yeah.
No.
And show them around?
No. I pointed them back to the stairs and said, at the bottom, go right.
Now get out of here.
Go to the water.
Get over there.
You'll know you're there when you see the water. How about that?
How do I get to Arizona? Just drive south until you see cactus.
There you go. That's right. That's exactly right. Well, Dave's here to keep us up on all the news. Sam's here with the latest sports. Producer Jasmine is here to field your phone calls, and you can give us a call at 312-981-7200. You can text us at that very same number, 312-981-7200. We're also on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. We're on Twitter at @SundaySpin. And engineer Bob is right here alongside me in the Allstate Showcase studio, twisting the dials and punching the buttons. Remember, you can find all of our shows on WGNRadio.com. You can also get our podcasts through iTunes just by searching for my name, Rick Pearson. Coming up, we've got another great show today. After Dave's 7:30 news update, my Tribune colleague Juan Perez Jr. is here, and we'll be talking about the Chicago Public Schools. After the 8 o'clock news, we'll be speaking to Leanne Redden. She's the executive director of the Regional Transportation Authority, and we'll talk about how the Springfield stalemate is affecting mass transit. And then after the 8:30 news update, we'll be joined by my good friend Chris Mooney. Chris is director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs for the University of Illinois. We'll be talking Springfield and Washington politics. That's all coming up, but now it's time for a quick break. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Welcome back to The Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Showcase studio in Michigan Avenue, overlooking a kind of soggy Michigan Avenue. The rain appears to have stopped. We can expect some kinds of these spotty showers to take place throughout the day. It's time for our weekly spin through national politics, and let's start back to last week where the Senate was coming into session and gun legislation was going to be considered, to Democratic-backed measures, to Republican-backed measures, and in the end, nothing. Here's Illinois' senior senator, Dick Durbin.
We must never forget our obligation to do everything we can to keep America safe. Our first obligation, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, secure domestic tranquility in the United States. If that is our obligation, there's much more that needs to be done. Keeping America safe from gun violence. Thousands of Americans are shot and killed each year in shootings that could have been prevented. There are steps we can take consistent with our Constitution and with our tradition of supporting hunting, sport shooting, guns for self-defense. We can still take meaningful steps to avoid tragic death, and we shouldn't be afraid to do that.
Well, the Senate's inaction carried over to the House floor, where Democrats staged a 25-hour sit-in. Here's what it sounded like on the House floor where Democrats chanted.
No break, no bail, no break, no bail, no break, no bail, no break, no break, no bail, no break, no bail, no break, no bail, no break, no bail,
no break, no bail,
no break, no bail,
no break,
no break, no bill. But the early morning hours of Thursday found Republican House Speaker Paul Ryan adjourning the chamber. Ryan wasn't pleased with the sit-in theatrics, and Democrats may not have helped their own cause by trying to use the sit-in to raise campaign money. Here's House Speaker Paul Ryan.
We can disagree on policy, but we do so within the bounds of order and respect for the system. Otherwise, it all falls apart. I'm not going to dwell on the decorum of the House here today, other than to say, we are not going to allow stunts like this to stop us from carrying out the people's business. Why do I call this a stunt? Well, because it is one.
Meanwhile, another busy week on the road to the White House. Presumptive Republican nominee Donald Trump went on the attack, criticizing Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton over her private email server while she was serving as Secretary of State.
Then there are the 33,000 emails she deleted. Well, we may not know what's in those deleted emails. Our enemies probably know every single one of them. So they probably now have a blackmail file over someone who wants to be the President of the United States. This fact alone disqualifies her from the presidency.
But Clinton had her own comeback, attacking Trump for refusing to release his income tax returns and contending that maybe the Donald isn't really worth what he claims to be.
Every major presidential candidate in the last 4 decades has shown the American people their taxes. In fact, Donald actually told Mitt Romney to do it. And he said that if he ever ran for president, he would release his returns. My husband and I have released ours going back nearly 40 years. And now Donald's refusing to do so. You have to ask yourself, what's he afraid of? Maybe that we'll learn he hasn't paid taxes on his huge income. We know that happened for at least a few years. He paid nothing or close to it. Or maybe he isn't as rich as he claims.
Now, the Trump campaign also went through some upheaval, showing little money raised and a still small campaign staff. Trump fired his longtime campaign manager, Corey Lewandowski. Lewandowski, a controversial figure. He was interviewed on CNN, and Lewandowski admitted he's a pretty intense guy.
Look, I think I'm a very intense person, and my expectation is perfection, because I think that's what Mr. Trump deserves. Yeah, I had a nice conversation with Mr. Trump, and I said to him, it's been an honor and a privilege to be part of this, and I mean that from the bottom of my heart.
Now, Lewandowski may be intense, but he's also got a new job. It seems like shortly after that interview with CNN that the network hired him to provide insights on the Trump campaign, reportedly at several $100,000. Then, of course, we had Brexit, the surprising vote by the UK to end their 40-year connection to the European Union. Donald Trump, traveling in Scotland after the historic vote, spent 12 minutes extolling the virtues of his rehab of the Turnberry golf course before he finally got down to discussing Brexit and the votes behind it.
I think people really see a big parallel. A lot of people are talking about that, and not only the United States, but other countries. People want to take their country back. They want to have independence, in a sense, and you see it with Europe, all over Europe. You're going to have more than just, in my opinion, more than just what happened last night. You're going to have, I think, many other cases where they want to take their borders back. They want to take their monetary back. They want to take a lot of things back. They want to be able to have a country again. So I think you're going to have this happen more and more. I really believe that, and I think it's happening in the United States.
That's Donald Trump making the comparison of Brexit to the United States voters coming in November. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Up ahead on The Sunday Spin, my Tribune colleague Juan Pelhez Jr., he covers the Chicago Public Schools. We'll be talking about, obviously, the school's cash crisis, what may be next, as well as the recent discoveries of the lead in drinking water in some of the Chicago public schools and what's going on with that as well. Also, then after the 8 o'clock news from Dave, we'll be speaking to Leanne Redden, executive director of the RTA. We'll talk about the RTA's capital needs and how that runs up against the Springfield impasse. And we'll be closing out the show with my good friend and good friend of the show, Chris Mooney. Chris is director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs for the University of Illinois, and we'll talk about Springfield and Washington politics.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. I'm Rick Pearson, and this is your Sunday Spin. A little rainy, hearing some thunder out there on the Storm Center patio this morning, but It still is a little bit muggy out there as well. Joining me here in the Allstate Showcase studio is Juan Perez Jr. He's the Chicago Public Schools correspondent for the Chicago Tribune, my good colleague, and never a dull moment when it comes to CPS.
Yeah, no kidding. It's every time we do this, every time we sit down, what crisis has beset the school system? What has it been? What's the news? And luckily, we've had a pretty busy week this week, I guess.
Well, a very busy week. We had Governor Rauner at the Tribune editorial board, yep, repeating his calls for his belief that CPS should be able to file for bankruptcy.
Yep.
We had the protests by the teachers.
Not far from here. Yeah. City Hall all morning.
Yes. And we have the continued saga of the testing for lead in the city's public schools.
Right. Yeah, there's that, too.
Let's go first to the money.
All right.
So we have CPS.
Where is it?
Yeah, well, that's exactly the question, isn't it? CPS saying that it faces a billion-dollar deficit.
Yeah.
We have the legislature is scheduled to actually convene in session for the first time.
I'm really curious about that.
And that's on Wednesday.
Yeah.
And there has been some progress made in what's known as a stopgap budget. That would be a six-month temporary budget. But I think the real question comes down to is what is in it for the Chicago Public Schools?
You know, I walked up, I was at a meeting for lead, you know, a school meeting about lead in the water. And I heard that lawmakers were going to get called back in next week. So I walked up to an official and I was like, okay, what is this? What's going on? And the answer I got was, well, what do you think this is? Is this more theater? And I'm like, I'm asking you. You really, you know, but that's, I think that that's a little bit of the prevailing sentiment out there. I mean, you know, when you ask folks, you know, what's happening out there, I think there's a little bit of a reigning sense of confusion and, you know, some mixed signals coming out of Springfield right now. And I think there, you know, folks, stakeholders, if you want to call them that, who are in the game right now are sitting here kind of thinking like, what is it that's going to happen? You know, because we're the pool of options is kind of dwindling a little bit here the closer and closer we get to schools opening.
Well, you have the governor that had proposed a full year education plan, but would only kind of hold harmless Chicago Public Schools by about $75 million.
And you would actually, the way he would argue, I think he would argue that they would actually see a little bit more money than they did last year under that proposal. But that's, I don't know if I want to call it a non-starter from the school district's perspective, but you know they're not buying it. You know, at least officially, they're not buying that. Really interesting to hear the governor's comments this weekend about the school system's finances too. You know, as he was doing kind of his barnstorming tour of across the media outlets across the city here. You know, what were some of the big things that he said about Chicago Public Schools? I mean, that the financial crisis is of its own making. I mean, I'm paraphrasing here. The financial crisis is of the district's own making, he said.
Mismanaged.
It's mismanaged. It's been run as a patronage network for years, if not decades. He said that I guess he presented his what he sees as the range of options that are available to the school district and the city, and that's raise property taxes. You see him kind of needling the mayor a little bit by saying, you know, he could, you know, Rom could get a good contract with the teachers union, but I don't think he's going to do that, you know,
right.
So, and then advancing the bankruptcy talk again.
Which he had actually kind of toned that down for a while. And now it's back up to full volume again. And of course you need legislation to do that. And that's not going to pass.
Not to mention the fact that, you know, a bankruptcy filing of that size for the school district would be quite an undertaking. Let me put it that way. It would be quite an undertaking. It would be fascinating to watch just because there are so many hurdles that you would have to jump through before you even get to the point of actually, you know, filing for bankruptcy and actually qualifying as bankrupt. It would be interesting to see if the proceedings alone, if it actually reached that point, if he actually got to a point where he could walk into a courtroom and ask a judge, like, let's start this process. Those proceedings alone, you know, some experts I've heard say, you know, those proceedings alone are often sufficient to get something done because you've just, you know, it
just by the sheer magnitude of making such a filing.
It almost serves as a cudgel on its own. But again, before we even get to that point, legally speaking, there's a lot that has to happen at the state level and, you know.
Right.
You know, I can't, right now, I can't see legislation actually getting through both houses and then actually under the governor's desk that would, you know, even allow that to happen.
Right. But as we have lawmakers coming back to Springfield and continuing to look at this issue of education funding, the fact that without a school appropriation, CPS says it's not going to open.
Yeah.
You have other school districts around the state that are financially stressed and they won't be able to open, and people looking at, you know, is this kind of game of chicken that's been going on, is it the schools and the fear of the wrath of parents, is that going to be,
is it going to be enough,
is that going to be enough, right? And but you still have to think that any kind of education bill that passes out of Springfield is going to have hundreds of millions of dollars, a couple, 400, is going to have money, extra money, for the Chicago Public Schools in it.
Okay, but where does it come from? Where does that cash come from?
That's exactly right.
And so Right. And so you and I are sitting here as it starts to rain here on beautiful Michigan Avenue in Chicago, you know, where I don't know where that money's going to come from.
Well, and that part
they'll find a way, but
well, but part of the issue is too is, you know, even if it is a couple of $100 million, whatever, and you're talking a full year education appropriation, mm-hmm. you're only talking a 6 month appropriation for the rest of state government to function, and that's the let's put it off after the election, let's take all of the side issues and put them away and put them in a lockbox till after the election, and then comes the hard bargaining, the lame duck session of the mm-hmm. legislature post-election about cuts and tax increases.
The way somebody phrased it to me earlier this week was there's kind of two options. There's like a muddle-through option, you know, which is kind of what you're talking about here, you know, kind of nip-tuck your way sort of through the elections and kind of, you know, get your way past November and open schools with a line of credit and basically try to get to the second semester and you know, basically put yourself in the same position that you were at over the course of months here. Or there's an option, or there's the warfare option, the nuclear option, right, where you just slash everything, you cut everything, you know, the teachers would strike over cuts of, you know, a considerable magnitude, especially ones that hit their paychecks. At least that's what they've said. So,
well, and you have the governor, if we assume that a bill passes for education funding and it does have more money for Chicago public schools than what the governor has offered, he's pretty much said that he's going to veto it. And, you know, we've heard his comments repeatedly that, you know, he is not going to support a Chicago school bailout, using that term bailout. And that's something that's also been being echoed by the Rauner-controlled Republican Party and the House Republican Organization in some of their robocalls that they are doing. They're actually launching another $100,000 of TV ads on cable TV. This is, I believe, the third week in a row, going after targeted Democrats in their effort to erode support and using, of course, the connection of linkage to House Speaker Michael Madigan, and that Madigan's trying to lead this bailout effort. And then you have Democrats saying, well, there are issues of equity concerns, issues of equity involving pensions, those kinds of things. And then you've got the overall call of redoing the entire school aid formula.
Yeah, it was interesting to watch the big idea of rebooting, you know, control alt deleting the school funding formula, just how that utterly failed this year in the regular session. You know, it's just that's a big rock to move, and it's super complicated. And, you know, there's a few people out there, I mean, you can probably count them on one hand, who really, really know this stuff through and through. And I think that sometimes it's hard to get that, you know, it's hard to explain it sometimes. It's, you know, the school funding formula and all the intricacies involved in it. So, you know, is that going to be a permanent impediment, or at least a consistent impediment to getting a broader deal done? I don't know. I mean, maybe. But, you know, at the very least, I think, you know, what the district could probably use now is, or at least what part of what they're asking for is this idea of being able to boost the city's property taxes by a little bit in order to come up with a new line of revenue to devote exclusively to teacher pensions, right? And I'm not sure, you know, when the governor says that, you know, one of the options available to the city to solve the school's problems is a tax hike, I mean, is he signaling an openness to, you know, signing off on something that would contain that? Maybe, I don't know. But that's probably going to have to be part of, you know, whatever solution comes forward here.
We're speaking with my Tribune colleague Juan Perez Jr., Chicago Public Schools correspondent for the Chicago Tribune. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the All-State Showcase Studio in Tribune Tower on Michigan Avenue. And joining me here in studio is my Tribune colleague, good friend Juan Perez Jr., Chicago Public School reporter. And we're talking about CPS, I guess we should also bring into this another few initials, CTU, the Chicago Teachers Union, and we talked about they had their protests. What were they protesting?
Well, so you'll remember back on April 1st, they absolutely flooded streets in a call, in what they described as a call for the state to bring in some revenue to the school district, right? This time they're looking inward a little bit more, and what you saw last week was a much smaller turnout for whatever reason, going directly to City Hall and obviously the Thompson Center and a few other sites around downtown, looking at local options for revenue. Okay, we're talking about how to come up with cash, right? And so the union has talked about this package that it's advanced of revenue generating ideas, which means tax hikes, that they think could bring a lot of money into the school system. And as they would argue, you know, the city should institute these tax increases as kind of a show of good faith to Springfield. And by doing this, you know, they put some skin in the game and Springfield sees that they're, you know, that the city is willing to do something, and then compromise comes from there, right? So let's boost some fees on ride sharing services, the hotel tax, fuel taxes. You know, let's one of the ideas that they had talked about was redirecting some of the proposed borrowing and investments for the Lucas Museum site and pouring that back into the schools. But never mind. But the idea is that, you know, what they're arguing is that the city can do more on its end to come up with dough to fix this. And so, you know, I think that's really the idea. You know, they're, you know, outside of the city council chambers, you know, is it super full inside a city hall there. You know, again, interesting times, but we, you know, I don't know that they are seeing the path forward here. You know, like we're kind of waiting to see, like, which road is it going to be, you know?
Right.
The muddle through option, or is it the warfare option? Shrug. Don't know yet.
Yeah. And I mean, our first indication probably will be coming on Wednesday when we see exactly if lawmakers act and do anything.
They can do
on
something.
Funding.
Yeah.
But
I mean, well, so what does do anything mean? I mean, does that mean that they send something that the governor ultimately has to veto?
Well, that goes to the heart of it, because, you know, if it does contain a significant amount of money for Chicago Public Schools, I mean, then does he veto it?
Yeah,
and does that take the funding for all the other school districts along with it?
I don't know how they're going to do it. I mean, that would seem to be. Now, I'm sure there's ways that they could write in legislative language that would allow for some, like we were talking about earlier, some degree of revenue opportunities that might fall a little bit more directly on the city, right? You know,
sure. If I mean, that kind of an authorization for
the
Chicago
pension levy. Yeah, yes, the pension levy plus right. You know, the stopgap kind of K-12 funding to kind of get us through November kind of thing. You know, maybe that's something that comes forward. You know, but you're probably right. Anything more than that, anything that somebody would be able to characterize as a special deal for Chicago, quote unquote.
Or a bailout
I don't see how politically the governor wouldn't see his only option as vetoing that, whatever it might be.
And but then again, you run the risk of, you know, here we're back to the game of chicken again about whether the school's open and who gets blamed for that coming, you know, in the November election.
I thought this was supposed to be about the kids.
Well, and, you know, when we talked about that issue about bankruptcy, too, that's an issue that I've seen people raise is, you know, if CPS were to have the authority and power to file for bankruptcy, the question, you know, what about the kids?
Yeah.
Because that becomes just a financial discussion of who gets what.
Right.
And, you know, here left out of that are the kids. Speaking of the kids, you've been also writing a lot about this issue of lead being found in the drinking water, and
fascinating, right? I mean, here we are, Flint, Michigan, dominating the headlines. And I'm sorry, I accidentally stole a little clip off your desk here as I show you here. But
you're allowed to use your own stories as a cheat sheet here. It's okay.
Well, let me see what I can come up with off the top of my head. Yeah, you know, Flint. They, you know, like one expert put it to me this way a few days ago, if it wasn't for Flint, they wouldn't be doing this at all. They wouldn't actually be going through this process of, you know, spot checking water, you know, levels of lead in water at schools, you know, kind of throughout the district here. And that's where we are today. And, you know, what you're seeing here, all right, the district is making a big point of talking about results. Let me start over here. Here's kind of how it works. And this is a very, very, if there's anybody listening here who I've been talking to about this, if there's anybody from Department of Water Management or if Forrest Claypool's on the air or if the facilities people are on the air, I'm just giving a very broad overview, folks, here, okay? You know, they're basically going through and, you know, pulling five samples from water fountains and sinks at a, you know, few hundred schools across the city. You test each of those and you try to find out how much lead there is in those water samples, you know, in that snapshot in time. And the results that the district is trying to point at are the ones that fall below this level of 15 parts per billion of lead. And they're saying, you know, look at this broad array of results that we're getting that fall below 15 parts per billion. And we've got about roughly a third of the schools that we've tested. Only a third of the schools that we've tested so far, the district would say, had at least one test result at one water fixture that landed at or above 15 parts per billion. That threshold, that 15 parts per billion threshold, is something that the EPA, it's a little bit of an arbitrary measure of risk, is how one person described it to me. It's, you know, because there is the CDC and health experts everywhere broadly agree that there is no safe exposure. No safe level of exposure at any level, right? And it's especially worrisome for younger kids. But now the district has a little bit of an issue on its hands because as they're, you know, they're going through and they're pulling more and more of these results, you see, you know, a lot of results that land between 5 and 10 parts per billion. There's, a, you know, quite a few that land between 10 and 15 parts per billion. And there's also a lot that, you know, have lower than that 5 mm-hmm. part per billion threshold. And I just say 5 because, you know, bottled water, you know, the bottle of water that I chugged in the car on the way over here this morning, that's regulated by the Food and Drug Administration as opposed to the EPA, and the maximum level of lead that can be in there in bottles of water, according to the FDA, is 5 parts per billion. So just to kind of give people a sense of
the scale,
the swinging scale of what federal regulations say about the acceptable levels of lead in the water. But then you've got, you know, this week the district, you know, this past week, district officials, Claypool himself, top health department officials, the Department of Water Management, going across the city to a series of community meetings to actually try to sit down and talk with people about what they have found and what parents can do about this whole issue. And, you know, I was surprised at the turnout, honestly, in a lot of cases. You know, you saw a couple of meetings there where you had maybe a couple dozen parents, a couple dozen parents there. And then you saw a couple where it was just, you know, crickets, you know, inside of a, you know, the one meeting that I went to, I think it was on Thursday. It was actually kind of nice. You had two or three community members come in. And so, you know, everybody who's in the room, the whole gamut of people who were in the room expecting to talk to a classroom full of people, just kind of sit down at their table and have a conversation with them, which was nice to see. But I don't know, you know, I guess I can guess at why, but I don't really know for certain why the turnout was a little bit low at some of these things, at least just from my personal observations. You know?
I mean, just given the seriousness of this issue.
Yeah, it is. It is serious.
I mean, and again, it's no secret about the effects of lead on developing minds and developing growing children. And one thing I thought was interesting, too, as we talk about here the cash-strapped CPS, is that you have Forrest Claypool saying, money's no object. We're going to spend what it takes to fix this.
Yeah, and so it's still not clear what, quote-unquote, fix this means. They're going to come up with some kind of solution sort of on a school-by-school basis, but, you know, what is it actually going to look like? You know, is it going to be... is there going to be a protocol where, you know, each school superintendent goes through the building each morning and flushes the water system for 5 minutes? You know, because that's something that you can do, you know, kind of moving water through pipes there. That's one thing you can do to kind of reduce the amounts of lead that you find inside the water. You know, so is there going to be some kind of protocol that you set up for the entire district? You know, what is the individual school remediation plan going to look like? Which is to say, you know, how are you going to fix this problem in each individual building where it pops up? You know, and then, yeah, how much is that going to cost? You know, Baltimore, you know, it's interesting. You know, a school kid in Baltimore, for example, will walk into, you know, will walk by a water fountain that has a giant sign by it that says, you know, do not drink from this fixture. You know, this is not suitable for human consumption. All those kids are drinking exclusively bottled water. You know, that's, you know, because of the issue there. That's, you know, Baltimore decided that was the most cost-effective way of handling it, was you just had bottled water everywhere. I don't know if that's what the district is going to do here. Maybe they install water filters on certain water fountains. Maybe they, you know, that's still to be determined. And so as a result, what you hear is that we don't really know how much this is going to cost yet. You know, now, there's one thing to consider here, too. There's a dedicated stream of revenue that the city school system now has on its hands right now in the form of this capital improvement tax, right? In which there's a new little levy that's brings in a few million dollars, more than a few million dollars a year, that can be devoted to infrastructure projects and also debt service.
Well, this would seem to be a capital infrastructure improvement project.
And so are they going to borrow? You know, they are probably going to borrow against that line of revenue. They can probably borrow a lot of money against that line of revenue. So you're going to have to balance kind of the sort of politically friendly school expansion projects and things like that, that, you know, those little things that you have to give out throughout the city, and then, you know, stuff like this too. So that's going to be really interesting to see how, if any, tension sort of builds as this sort of thing comes along, right?
Never a dull moment. Never a dull moment with CPS. Juan Perez Jr., thank you so much
for
joining me
this
morning. I appreciate it. We'll be back with more right after this. Up ahead on the Sunday Spin, we'll be speaking with Leanne Redden. Leanne is the executive director of the Regional Transportation Authority. We'll be talking about capital improvement needs for our mass transit.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in Tribune Tower on Michigan Avenue. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. Just in is a new Washington Post ABC News poll on the presidential race. If the election were held today and the candidates were Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, for whom would you vote? 51% Clinton, 39% Trump. Roughly 2 in 3 Americans say they think Trump is unqualified to lead the nation, are anxious about the idea of him as president, believe his comments about women, minorities, and Muslims show an unfair bias, and see his attacks on a federal judge because of his Mexican-American heritage as racist. A slimmer majority say they disapprove the way Clinton has handled questions about her use of a personal email server, and half of Americans are anxious about the prospect of a Clinton presidency, underscoring the historic unpopularity of the two major party candidates. You know, we talked about Donald Trump being in Scotland, advertising his golf course amid the Brexit vote, and it was there that he said that he believed a devalued British pound would help the economy and bring more tourists to his golf course. And that plays into a theme Clinton and her allies have been using against him, not only that he cares more about himself, but his belief in debt and lower wages. And here's a new ad from a Clinton-aligned super PAC.
I'm the king of debt. I love debt. I know more about debt than practically anybody. I love debt.
Would you be willing to use the debt limit and risk the possibility of the country going into default to get more spending cuts?
Okay. I would use the debt limit. I don't want to say. I want to be unpredictable because, you know, we need unpredictability. Everything is so predictable with our country.
You never have to default because you print the money, I hate to tell you, okay? So there's never a default.
Taxes too high, wages too high. We're not going to be able to compete against the world.
That's an ad from the Hillary-aligned super PAC against Donald Trump that's airing in some of these swing states that right now. Well, now we're going to go to the phones and talk to Leanne Redden. Leanne is executive director of the Regional Transportation Authority. Leanne, thank you very much for joining me this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you know, we've been talking a lot for over a year now about the state's budget impasse in Springfield. And, you know, it hits all sectors of government. And one of the things that I know a lot of people are concerned about, we had Don Schaefer from the Midwest Truckers Association talking about transportation infrastructure needs. And I know, you know, when it comes to infrastructure, one of those things that I consider to be infrastructure is also the RTA and the service boards.
Correct. I mean, we're a big part of the region's infrastructure. You know, we move the between CTA, Metro, and Pace, we move over 2 million people each day. And so while it's physically moving people, there's a lot of infrastructure that has to support that and get everybody where they plan to and expect to be on a daily basis.
And I don't know that we can ever catch up to the backlog of needs that exist in that infrastructure.
Well, I like to say you kind of never really catch up, but we certainly have to tackle it and we have to sort of chip away at it. You know, we have a pretty significant backlog of need that we didn't get overnight. We didn't, you know, achieve this overnight. We've been sort of facing years and years of underinvestments, both from the federal and the state levels. And we really have to try to, you know, I kind of think of it akin to laundry, you know.
You never catch up to it.
My laundry, as you know, those dirty socks are the ones that are going to be my next clean laundry. Then I become dirty laundry. So you just kind of got to keep working at it.
Well, and I mean, we're looking at, an amount that's in the billions of need.
Correct. We have about, you know, we say we need about 20 billion over the next 10 years. You know, and that's, you know, while that's a huge number, if you break it down to about $1.2 billion each year, but, you know, right now with zero state funding in our capital program, we're only spending this current year about $871 million. So, you know, about a third of what we need to be investing in the infrastructure.
So, and again, the inability to kind of catch up, and even just to even get to the level that would be like a maintenance level, that just further creates a backlog of need here.
Yeah, we're falling behind, and you know we're really, I mean, at a crisis phase. And unfortunately, I think the service board, CTA, Metro, and Pace have done a fantastic job of operating the system, you know, in a safe and a reliable way as they possibly can, you know, and spending the money on many customer-facing improvements, you know, the limited funds that we have. But sometimes it's a lot of the invisible stuff that people sort of take for granted and don't necessarily see. So it's the tracks, it's the signals, the switching systems that really need to be invested in. Otherwise, you know, we will start falling behind. And, you know, I mean, you look around the country, I mean, this is a national issue. It's not just unique to the Chicagoland area. But, you know, other areas around the country have actually started to sort of prioritize investment in infrastructure, investment in their transit systems. And what I personally worry about is us getting left behind. You know, we spend now half of what New York spends on an annual basis in terms of investment in their transit infrastructure. L.A. is right behind that. And, you know, wouldn't it be ironic if we kind of squander the resources that we have here in terms of a very robust transit system and let that sort of fall apart and get left behind?
How much of the issue, and you know, we talk about this at the federal level, we talk about it at the state level, about just is our system of funding, like, for example, the use of the road fund at the state level, is it a funding system that's kind of becoming outmoded?
Well, I mean, I think in the long term, potentially. I mean, we're talking, you know, the road fund is supported primarily by gas taxes. It's been the source of revenue. I mean, the part of the issue is we haven't raised any of those taxes or fees, you know, in many, many years since the 90s. And so it just doesn't have the buying power. I mean, but then you layer on top of that the fact that, you know, vehicles are becoming more efficient. Some are even electric now, so they're not even sort of purchasing gasoline. And I think we have to think about the longer-term solutions, funding sources. But, you know, in the short term, let's be realistic about this. You know, people have talked about things like vehicle miles taxes or travel taxes, those kinds of things. But that's going to take some time and effort and policy and infrastructure to get set up to actually create a sustainable and sufficient revenue fund to support infrastructure. But in the short term, really, I mean, I think it is going to be sort of gas tax and some of the usual suspects, if you will, for the next few years while we sort of on a parallel path look at long-term other solutions. But, I mean, bottom line is what we need in public transit as well as broader infrastructure is a long-term stable funding source, predictable funding source that we can sort of plan against and build against to deliver, I think, the assets and the resources that this region needs, because it really does drive our economy.
We're speaking with Leanne Redden. She is the Executive Director of the Regional Transportation Authority. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. We're speaking with Leanne Redden. She's Executive Director of the Regional Transportation Authority. Leanne, I was looking at some of the numbers involving the RTA. 6,100 vehicles, 1,400 track miles, $100 billion worth of subway tunnels, 62% of people working in the loop that take mass transit to work, 4 billion miles traveled, 600 million rides, and yet we're not doing anything to be able to keep up with the infrastructure needs. I'm kind of curious because, and again, when I talked last week with Don Schaefer from the Midwest Truckers about transportation needs, I'm kind of curious about, you know, we keep talking about the Springfield stalemate and that kind of thing, but we haven't really heard much about any kind of a capital program for public works.
Unfortunately, you're correct. We haven't heard much about it. I mean, there's, and I think the stalemate in Springfield is sort of kept us all at bay. I mean, they're saying they won't deal with capital until they get a balanced budget. And, you know, so we're all sort of sitting, waiting. But the needs, as you mentioned earlier, keep growing. So it's a frustrating situation. You know, I just kind of keep beating the drum of what the infrastructure needs are, why it's an investment in, you know, and then that's the other point. I think it is really important to highlight. I think that this is an investment in our region's economy. This isn't a handout. This isn't a bailout. This is an investment that has very good returns on, you know, those dollars spent. And, you know, I think that it's something that Springfield really should be prioritizing. And, you know, and I continue to work with them as much as I can to try to get us to that point.
Well, and of course, whenever we do a capital program, it's traditionally done with a identified source of revenue, a new source of revenue. And unfortunately, as part of the overall discussion of the budget, we haven't even heard them talking about sources of revenue just for the operating budget of the state, let alone to talk about, you know, what sources could be tapped to leverage the bonding needed for a, you know, a very aggressive capital program.
Exactly. And, you know, I don't have a crystal ball. I don't pretend to have all the answers. You know, I mean, I don't certainly envy the task at hand in Springfield. It's a very challenging, tough situation that they're in. But, you know, I mean, we were talking a little bit earlier about, you know, gas tax that hasn't been raised. You know, there's been other discussions about vehicle miles travel. There's been talk about sales tax expansion, income tax. You know, I personally, you know, am agnostic as to which one of those funding is funding. And as if we can get the appropriate funding to support the investment in infrastructure, I think it's important. And the other thing I think to highlight, too, in the transit space, we have both, you know, operating and capital cost needs. And largely we support much of the operating costs out of the, you know, the sales tax revenues that are generated, fare revenue that customers and riders pay on a daily basis, which, you know, covers about 80% of the operating costs. And then a small portion of money does come from Springfield as well.
Well, and when is the last time that there was state capital money available to the RTA?
So we still have some money flowing, very limited from the last state capital program. But I think, you know, it's no secret to anybody that's listened to the radio or read a newspaper that, you know, those monies are running out, drying up. The state just issued some bonds, actually just this past week, to actually just keep the current projects that are in the works underway and moving, so we can actually sort of keep some of that minimal construction. But, you know, right now in the transit space, we're looking at about half of the existing, albeit small, capital program is actually slowing down or stopping. And that's a really frustrating situation to be in. We just can't, you know, we don't have any state monies. And one of the bigger risks that we face in the future, if this isn't settled, is we could risk actually leaving federal dollars on the table because we will have no state monies to actually match them.
And that's across the board with the state. I mean, it's not just federal transportation funding. It's also some of those social service programs, healthcare programs where the state finds itself, you know.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, this is unfortunately a sort of a crisis for the entire state, and all programs, you know, be it social services or, you know, transportation and infrastructure, We're all struggling to sort of keep up, do what we need to do, provide the services that we need to provide on a daily basis. And it's a challenging situation.
When we talk about federal funding, and of course, we just had finally, I guess, a new transportation bill. But is that sustainable, a sustainable source of revenue for the region?
It is. I mean, we have the, you know, I mean, interesting or kind of almost ironic, you know, Congress came together and passed a bipartisan bill this current year. And, you know, that gives us a five-year outlook or 5 years of some stability. I mean, it's still not enough. You know, they kind of kicked the can on dealing with the Highway Trust Fund and providing sort of expanded and more reliable funding. But we do have a five-year outlook. So it gives us something to work against. But, you know, as we're talking about in Illinois, I don't have sort of the state piece of the puzzle fitting in very well right now. And it presents a lot of challenges and uncertainty.
Does that portend even the need for more fare increases?
Well, I mean, at this point, where you know we're actually starting the process of discussing with CTA Metro and Pace what the next year's budgets are going to look like for 2017. You know, these are things we talk about all the time. I think if we get no resolution out of Springfield, you know, absolutely some combination of fare increases, potentially service cuts, all of those things have to be considered because, you know, if we don't have the monies to pay, we will have to start looking at making some of those tough decisions.
How do you put a budget together with that vacuum of not knowing what the state may do?
Well, on the operating side, we've been able to kind of pull it together. As I mentioned, you know, on the operating costs, we still get fare revenue and sales tax is still being collected and we're receiving those. The state funding that is provided to us comes to us actually through what they call a continuing appropriation. So it is still flowing right now, essentially without a budget, and it does regardless of whether the state passes a budget. We have been hit with some cuts on the operating side in terms of grants and other funding that supports some of the other programs that we have to provide, reduced and free ride programs. Mm-hmm. The state mandates that we provide free rides for people with disabilities and seniors. And, you know, there is money that usually flows to us to actually subsidize some of that cost. But those revenues have been dwindling as well. So, you know, we're cobbling it together, I guess, on the operating side, but it's the capital side right now that is really the bigger, longer-term worry that we have.
Leanne Redden, Executive Director of the Regional Transportation Authority, thanks for laying out the situation as far as what's needed, and let's see what happens.
Thanks, Rick. I appreciate your time this morning.
We'll be back with more right after this. Up ahead on the Sunday Spin, my good friend Christopher Mooney. He's the director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois System. And Chris and I will be talking everything from the Springfield impasse to the effect of the presidential race on some of our local races here in Illinois in November.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and this is your Sunday Spin on this very muggy Sunday morning. The little sprinkles have now stopped downtown, but the humidity is still in the air, and you can definitely feel it. Well, not exactly presidential news, but maybe kind of, sort of. Florida Senator Marco Rubio, after losing his bid for the Republican nomination for the White House, has reversed course and is now running for re-election as a senator. Now, perhaps it's a way to keep in the ballgame for a future presidential run? He says no. But here's how he explained it to Fox News.
So I know people in politics don't like to admit they've changed their mind, but I changed my mind. And people of Florida deserve to know why. And there's a lot of reasons. You know, I think it's been clearly outlined that I'm frustrated by what's happening here in the Senate. most Americans are, with the gridlock and the inability to move forward on things. But the Senate's also a place where you can serve your constituents with constituent service, which is very rewarding. And I said that during the campaign. It's a place where you can hopefully be able to still move on some major issues, although it hasn't happened enough, but we were able to do a little of that. But I think the real reason, and the deepest reason why, is I think no matter who wins this presidential election, the Senate's role of being able to act as a check and balance on bad ideas from the president, I think, are going to matter more in 2017 than they perhaps ever have in our history.
Kind of an interesting statement there about the role of the Senate, no matter who wins the presidency. Also, we had a deadlocked Supreme Court, which allowed to let stand a lower court ruling, which found President Obama had exceeded his power in granting legal status to immigrants, many families of U.S. citizens, the ruling affecting up to 4 million people. Here's the president's reaction.
But for more than two decades now, our immigration system, everybody acknowledges, has been broken. And the fact that the Supreme Court wasn't able to issue a decision today doesn't just set the system back even further. It takes us further from the country that we aspire to be.
That was President Obama's reaction on the Supreme Court's 4-4 deadlock on his executive actions on immigration. Well, joining me now on the phone is Chris Mooney, and Chris is director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs for the University of Illinois. And Chris, again, another kind of wild and woolly week in politics across the nation. And, you know, a lot of people are trying to interpret that the surprising results of the Brexit in the UK and trying to draw some parallels to what could happen as far as a Trump vote in November.
Yeah, it's been a crazy old week and another crazy old year of politics around here. I mean, I would say this about Illinois politics, and I think it applies this year to 2016. You know, it's really exciting. If it's like a roller coaster, it's really exciting if you don't throw up.
That's why you're an expert. That's why you're an expert.
Strong stomach.
Yes, yeah. You need a strong stomach. Well, let's first talk about Springfield. We have the legislature is going to convene for the first time since they adjourned at the end of May. They're going to convene. Expectations are they're going to consider some kind of a, quote, stopgap short-term budget bill and some kind of an education funding bill as well. But beyond that, no one really, you know, can say much about the details.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think at this point nobody knows almost anything about how this is going to play out. It's been that way for many months. It's really sort of, you know, a lot of people that get worried about what's going on in the state, and they should, because it's really, I mean, what we've got going on now is the worst budget situation that any state, you know, since the Great Depression has dealt with, and it's a completely self-inflicted wound. We've done this to ourselves because of a failure of the leaders in the General Assembly and the governor to sit down and come to an agreement about what we ought to be doing going forward in terms of how much we ought to be taxing, what we ought to be spending on, and so forth. Some very fundamental choices that the legislative process generally deals with every year, but this year it just has, or this year and last year just hasn't done it. And so this, you know, the idea now that maybe they're going to get a stopgap bill and get through till November or whenever, you know, that's in the air, and we live in such a weird world that sounds like progress, right? That sounds like something that's a good thing. When in fact, really, the longer we put this off, the worse the problem gets, because every day we spend more money, we're taken in, and every day, you know, the sort of social fabric and the fabric of government in this state are just deteriorating further and further.
Well, you know, we noted about how last year when the governor vetoed a budget except for signing the education portion, that provided kind of a safety valve, at least by having funding for the schools. And I have to wonder if some of this renewed talk about, you know, perhaps doing an education funding bill isn't the fact that maybe the stakes are so high that the game of chicken and the game of blame, the risk is so great that something will have to be done.
Well, I hope so. I really, all along here, I've been confused by the governor's approach and not in sort of avoiding crises, because that's usually how these things get done. The reason, I mean, well, there's multiple reasons why things are going as they are right now. But one of the reasons is it's just a really, really hard problem. And, you know, our finances are so screwed up that, you know, it's going to dig, you know, we're not an impoverished state. You know, we're not Mississippi or Louisiana. But we do have problems, and our tax, you know, our tax structure is weird, and it's not very efficient, and and we're spending more than we're taking in, and we have to make decisions about how to rectify that, because we've got to have there's got to be, just like in a family budget, we've got to take in a certain amount of money, and we can't spend more than that, and so we have to decide, do we want to. Do we want to do all these things we've been doing, or which ones do we want to keep doing? And then what are we willing to pay for? So we've got to make those decisions. Those are very, very difficult decisions, because we've been spending more than we've been taking in really for a long time in one way or the other. For example, with pensions, we haven't been paying the full freight on pensions. So we've been spending that money for current services. We've been buying roads and having programs and whatnot, but we haven't been saving, and that's a mismatch between spending and revenue, and we got to fix that. And it's very difficult, because it's going to mean we have to cut services, and we have to raise taxes in some proportion to be determined by policymakers. Neither of those things does any politician want to do.
Right, and so when you do this short-term stopgap, I mean, that's pushing those hard and very necessary decisions. They're putting them down the road.
Exactly. And again, every day we dig a bigger hole, we owe more money, and that makes the problem harder. So it's not helping to have a stopgap. It's merely putting off the inevitable and making it more difficult for when it does come.
And I'm not so sure that even – you know, if you look at the political climate and you look at, flash forward to post-election or January, that you're still going to have the political will to make those hard choices.
No, I mean, I see absolutely nothing that this election will impact. I mean, it's not going to change anything, right? I don't think. I mean, who knows? It's possible, and there may be a great groundswell of support for the Republican Party, and the governor may ride to victory and take over both chambers. But the odds of that are extraordinarily low, given the demographics of the state and given the way that the legislative districts are drawn, and given where the incumbents are now. I mean, it's possible, but it's not very likely.
We're speaking with Christopher Mooney, director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase studio, and on the phone is my good friend Christopher Mooney, director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs for the University of Illinois. It's always a mouthful. I'm sorry, Chris.
Yeah, sorry about that, Rick. We're working on it.
Hey, I got this a letter from a gentleman in Wilmette who said that a couple of shows ago I had Governor Edgar on, and the writer says it was like a breath of fresh air listening to how he managed his relationships with other elected officials. Civil talk, working things out, mutual compromise, no shaming, no blaming, working together to achieve results. And the writer questions, would it be better if maybe Governor Edgar was called in to mediate the discussion? And is that a possibility?
You say that was from Wilmette?
Yes.
Was it signed DR? I mean, was it the governor's wife, perhaps? maybe. I don't know.
No, it was not. There was nobody named Ron or so wrote this letter. But, I mean, it was kind of interesting in speaking with the governor, and at one point where he acknowledged that he's probably had more contact with Speaker Madigan than he has with Governor Rauner.
Yeah, I don't think they're – I mean, I don't really know what's going on with that. I mean, it's – you know, the current governor, you know, Governor Rauner is – he's very self-confident. He believes he knows what he's doing, and he's – you know, he told us in the election that he's been successful at everything that he ever did. And I'm sure that he feels that, you know, he's heading towards success in this particular new job that he's got.
Well, and I wonder, you know, you kind of touched on this before the break about what will happen in the fall elections. And, you know, we see this repeated effort by the governor to try to connect Democrats to Speaker Madigan and try to leverage the speaker's unpopularity. We also don't have a great deal of evidence that Governor Rauner is necessarily, you know, scoring well on job performance either. In the end, you know, I kind of wonder if this isn't kind of just a general anti-incumbent, they aren't doing anything kind of mood among voters come November.
Yeah, it could be. That's there's always that impulse in American politics that we don't like politicians, and we see politicians taking advantage of that. The governor took advantage of that. He said, you know, I'm not a politician. Please elect me governor. It's understandable. That's how America was founded, as a reaction towards a strong central government and the British government and so forth. We love liberty, and it's very much ingrained and deeply rooted in our political culture. But it is funny how people will run for office. You know, the current Republican presumptive nominee is an example, and our current governor. You know, it's as an anti-politician. It's like if you went in for a job as a baker, and you said, "Look, I don't know anything about bread. I never baked anything in my life. Please make me your next baker." And, you know, that's just the way we think about politics, that this can be done by somebody with common sense. Ross Perot, you know, when she famously said when he was running for president, "Let's just lift up the hood and fix her," you know. And I think the governor's realizing at this point that it's more complicated. It's, you know, there's a lot more moving parts. You know, you can't just go it alone. You got to work with people in a way that's just not top down, that you can perhaps when you're, you know, doing mergers and acquisitions.
You know, when some of the targeting that's been going on, when the House Republicans have been running ads and robocalls in some of the districts where they've targeted potentially vulnerable Democrats, and, you know, playing the game of, you know, this Democrat is in cahoots with Mike Madigan, and, you know, Madigan's trying to do a Chicago bailout of the schools, yep, and that kind of thing. And, you know, the regionalism, and obviously regionalism is always a part of the political game when it comes to playing down state. But you have to wonder, too, if in some of those areas where those Democratic office holders are more socially conservative, if, you know, that isn't kind of the same area where Donald Trump could do well, and there might be coattails for Republican legislative candidates.
Yeah, I think that is possible, especially, like you say, downstate. Governor Rauner, actually, outside of sort of Sangamon County, where Springfield is, and Champaign County, where U of I is, and, you know, Metro East, you know, governor's pretty popular down there. And at least from what I can tell, talking to people down there and what, you know, little polling there's been done. And so, yeah, he may be quite successful. But there's the problem for the governor in going with that strategy is that it may help him in downstate, but not that many people live downstate anymore. And especially relative to the number of people who live up in the northeastern part of the state. And, you know, he might be, in some sense, backing the wrong horse in the end. Now, there's a couple of House seats and a Senate seat way on the bottom of the state that are up for grabs that, you know, maybe, you know, the Republicans have been trying to get those seats for years, and maybe this is the year they get them because of the Trump phenomenon and this and the runner thing. But, you know, and there's a couple of other ones here and there. There's one in Kankakee that was been close the last couple of times when it went over in the Quad Cities. You know, so the governor may pick up a few, the Republicans may pick up a few seats in the legislature in November. There's certainly, that's certainly quite possible. It's also possible that they don't. And it's also possible that they lose a couple of seats. Kind of depends on how things play out over the course of the election. And especially, I think, is going to have, you know, the presidential election is going to have some impact on that, especially if things, you know, especially if Donald Trump goes really, really goes south. You know, it ends up being sort of the Alan Keyes of the Republican right. presidential candidates, you know. But, you know, that totally remains to be seen right now. I mean, he may, you know, it is not beyond the realm of possibility that Donald Trump, you know, wins in the fall and becomes, you know, he may become the next great president of the United States. I have no idea at this point. It's just a crazy year.
Well, and you know, when I mentioned about the issue of regionalism and regionalism, how it, you know, particularly downstate, but in some respects, it kind of reminds me of some of the rhetoric when then Republican Senate President James Pate Phillip from Wooddale was the Senate president here, and coming mm-hmm. from DuPage County, and you know, that kind of regionalism rhetoric, but I get a sense that that's kind of generationed out, though, and that maybe that regionalism game doesn't necessarily play as well as it once did in the suburbs.
Well, the suburbs is a different story. And, you know, for example, in DuPage County, there's now a Democratic senator named Cullerton who represents part of DuPage County. So,
right.
I mean, that's a, you know, it's a different world than it was when Pate Phillip was the president of the Senate. And part of that has to do with districting. The Democrats do maps, so they sort of had these long districts in many places, which sort of had parts in Chicago and parts out in the suburb, and that's how they've really kind of maximized their votes to get the maximum of receipts. And then you go to the exurbs, you go look at like Elgin and some of the ones that are sort of along that further rim. I mean, some of those are very Democratic now because of different changes in demographics and so forth. But downstate, the regionalism still is, you know, it's an anti-Chicago. Yeah, there's still – that still gets some traction down there. But I don't know if it's – I think you're right. I think in the suburbs it's different these days.
So I want you to put your betting hat on. And first, I mean – I think we have a belief. We've got both sides think they're winning. The Democrats mm-hmm. think they're winning. Rauner and Republicans think they're winning,
which is one of the problems.
Yeah, and truly, we won't know what kind of effects of things are going to, you know, play out here too. And a lot of times, as I say, in politics, politics can be affected by things totally beyond the control of the candidates and campaigns. But But do you expect that something's going to come out of Springfield on Wednesday?
I just don't know, and I kind of worry that it will, because I think what would come out would be, again, a stopgap thing that would get the schools open and let us limp along. And I think really, you know, as much as that is, it sounds kind of perverse for me to say that, I don't think that's good for the state, because more and more of these social service agencies are going to be going out of business. Bills are piling up. The universities, I don't know if we're, you know, are they going to close? Are they going to, you know, just deteriorate further? You know, small towns that have prisons in them are having to float alone to the state for all the utilities that they owe. I mean, it's just getting worse and worse and worse. And just putting it off another 6 months is just going to make it 6 months worse. So my feeling, you know, is all along, you know, what Ronald Reagan said about the Vietnam War. Let's have the bloodbath and get it over with.
And there is there's the optimism that permeates these discussions.
Yes,
Christopher Mooney, director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois, thank you so much, as always, for joining us this morning.
Yeah, my pleasure, Rick. Good luck.
We'll be back with more right after this.
Congratulations to this guy.
And it's a hat trick for Artemi Panarin.
A Timmy Panarin, 2016 Calder Trophy winner for Best Rookie.
And congratulations to this guy.
Make it 25 straight games with a play. Patrick Kane scores a power play goal.
Patrick Kane, 2016 Hart Trophy winner for league MVP.
It's time to get hungry for hockey again. The Blackhawks Convention is July 15th through 17th at Hilton, Chicago. We've got your free passes and live coverage ready on Blackhawks Radio, 720
WGN.
Majestic Star Casino is celebrating 20 years, so come join the party. Be here Saturdays for $120,000 anniversary drawings with a $20,000 winner each week. And Fridays, 68 winners will score the summer's hottest Bluetooth speaker, the Beats Pill by Dr. Dre, and a dream vacation. Majestic Star Casino, giving you beats, a beach, and bankroll. Prize amounts are promo cash. Visit MajesticStarCasino.com for details. Must be 21. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-9-WITH-IT.
Shoot,
your local Chevy dealers congratulate Patrick Kane, Hart Memorial Trophy winner.
Patrick Kane scores a power play goal.
On the road to the top, it's all about drive. Drive what Kane and Taves drive.
I'm certainly not the only one who says, I love this place. Jameson's Char House is the perfect spot to relax in a casual atmosphere that's warm and inviting. My wife and I frequently dine at the Huntley location. We enjoy hand-cut Black Angus steak, succulent chops, sometimes fresh fish favorites like the Greek-style Alaskan halibut served with rice pilaf and roasted asparagus, plus every side dish, warm oven-baked bread, and homemade soups and salad dressings, irresistible. Dine among family, friends, or business associates at any Jameson's Char House near you. I love this place.
Visit Jameson's Char House online at jamesons-charhouse.com. Jameson's Char House, offering lunch, dinner, private rooms, carry out, even purchase gift cards. Visit a Jameson's Char House near you in Mount Prospect, Bloomingdale, Woodridge, Crystal Lake, Huntley, Skokie, and in Glenview.
Well, that's all we have time for on this week's edition of the Sunday Spin. I want to thank my guests, my colleague from the Chicago Tribune, Juan Perez Jr. on the Chicago Public Schools, Leanne Redden, the executive director of the RTA, and Chris Mooney from the University of Illinois. But most of all, I want to thank all of you for listening. And now it's time for the pre-parade festivities from Dean Richards.
I guess you could say that. We're looking forward to the big parade. It's the rain has let up, at least for a little while here downtown.
And the humidity has only gotten worse.
And Bozo's hair says thank you for both of those things. Bozo is going to be on our WGN TV float along with Tom Skilling and a whole gang.
Cast of characters.
I'll be out there. I'm sure we've got all the WGN.
Are you going to be hopping between the two floats?
I tried that one year. I tried ziplining between the TV and the radio floats. I'm just going to stay on one of them this year for the safety of people on the street.
Thank goodness.
But we are floats 51 and 52. If you're going to be out there, look for us in the parade. That's going to be a blast. But I'll be here till 11 this morning, and I cannot wait to play this full interview that we did the other day with the legendary Dick Van Dyke.
Is there a nicer person around? I mean,
there is not.
It's back in Danville, hometown, and then he's in Chicago today.
Yeah, he's doing a couple appearances today. We'll talk about all of that, but couldn't be a nicer guy. He's 90 years old. He's dancing around with these kids from Danville High School and singing, and is so pleasant and so nice.
And I was glad to hear that there were actually lyrics to the theme song
from the Dick Van Dyke,
Dick Van Dyke show,
which he sings. And
yes,
we're going to get all to that in about a half an hour.
So what a tease, right? Perfect for you.
That's what we do here. We try to string you along for another half hour.